Next up on This Week in Law, it's Game On. We've got a special gaming panel here for you today. Suzanne Jacque's back on the show, along with Patrick Sweeney and Mona Ibrahim. We're going to talk about the big bucks of the gaming industry, the second most searched term on YouTube in 2014. What's new with Flappy Bird? How close the Supreme Court came to upholding California's ban on the sale of violent video games, and much, much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell. Episode 288, recorded January 16, 2015. It's a mod world. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by FreshBooks, the simple cloud accounting solution perfect for your law firm and any entrepreneur. Save time billing and get paid faster. Join the over 5 million users running their business with ease. Try it free at FreshBooks.com/TWiL. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. Thank you so much for joining us for This Week in Law. Game on, people. We are going to have an all gaming episode this week, and I am so excited about it because there's been so much going on this front. And I'm really thrilled to have a wonderful panel of lawyers and one law student who know a great deal about gaming law and all the current issues that if you're not thinking about, you should be. Coming back to the show is Suzanne Jacque. Hello, Suzanne. Great to have you again.
Hi. Stoked to be back on the show.
Suzanne is our law student. Remind me where you're going to school. I know it's in Chicago.
Chicago, Kent. It's right in the loop.
Got it. And Suzanne actually interns for our other two lawyer guests on the show. They are both practicing at IE Law Group. Patrick Sweeney is the founder of that law firm, also the founder of the Video Game Bar Association. Hello, Patrick.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having us.
I'm great. I'm thrilled you guys are here. Also with us is Mona, who works with Patrick, Mona Ibrahim. Hello, Mona.
Hi, everyone.
Hey, Mona. How did you and Patrick get together?
He was my professor at Southwestern, actually. I was taking the video game law agreement seminar that he teaches, and I wound up working with him later on. We stayed in touch.
Very good. So we have basically three levels of a law firm here. It might be fun for people to understand the different roles you guys play in your small firm, a little inside baseball for the legal practice. Patrick, could you fill us in a bit?
Sure. Yeah. So I started in the games business about 15, 16 years ago, doing transactional work for games clients. And when I started up the firm here about a little over a year ago, I reached out to Mona to help me with some of the work that I have to do, that sort of gets in the way of me running the business and, going out and talking to clients and going to trade shows and whatnot. So we split the work up relatively evenly. Certain areas are more up her alley. So like some of the privacy work that she does and the incorporation work and certain areas like the traditional Hollywood licensing or the publisher co-publisher arrangements, the clients expect me on the deal. So it really just depends on what we're working on. So we divide the work that way.
And like me for this show, I'm on my third and so grateful for all of them intern who've all worked with me remotely from a distance, except for our intern right now, Sando, actually just serendipitously is local to me here in Southern California. But with Suzanne in Chicago being an intern, is that something that you think is unique to a small firm such as yourself? Or is this something that the entire legal industry is seeing?
Well, I think it's more unique to the smaller end of the practice size in general, because I can be a little bit more nimble than, say, some of the bigger firms that I've been at before. And Denise, we talked about one that we shared in common. But, Suzanne is an avid gamer and has been focusing her education on the legal side. And we've met at conferences and I've seen some of her writing. And so she's very energetic and very interested and enthusiastic in this space. And so, you know, obviously I wanted to tap into that and put that to work for the firm. So she's been great. And that really doesn't matter where the person sits as far as I'm concerned.
And it's really interesting that you founded a video game bar association. I think there are a host of legal issues that are unique to the gaming field, and we're going to talk about a slew of them today, where, you know, perhaps copyright law cuts across all kinds of industries, but really unique issues come up for the gaming industry in general, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, we think so. And you know, years ago, there was a lot smaller sort of ecosystem of our peers, and we'd all bump into each other at the same conferences, or we'd be on the opposite side of a table in a deal or a controversy, you know, or certainly, you know, meet at the various trade shows. So we decided, you know, as the industry had grown and the proliferation of mobile and the tablet business and a lot of new entrants into the space, it would be nice if we all could still, you know, have a networking area or a networking organization to, you know, to keep up with best practices and just to, you know, stay tuned into who's doing what and where. And that really was the genesis of the Video Game Bar Association about 3 years ago.
Is it very big?
We've got about 60 members and in Europe and North America, and then a handful in Asia. And you know, it's certainly a small niche area of practice in general. But we don't have all of them in the organization yet. We're working on that. We hired a new executive director about a few months ago by the name of Joseph Olin, who used to run the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences and the DICE conference for video games. And so he's taken over and he's doing a great job so far. So we're looking forward to seeing the group grow.
All right. Well, just to frame our discussion today, there was an article I read, came out in December, and I read it over the holidays, that is from some part of Google that's called Think with Google. And I think it's mostly aimed at encouraging people to use their marketing services. It seems to have a real marketing bent to it and ends with some suggestions on how brands, and I hate that, you know, referring to certain companies as a brand, but that's exactly what they do in this piece, can harness the opportunity presented by the video game industry. It's a really interesting article because of the way that, let's see, it's written by, oh goodness, I'm going to have trouble pronouncing his name, but it's written by a Googler. And you can check it out, of course, with everything else we discussed today in our discussion points at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/288. Really interesting piece. And to sort of encourage people to use Google's marketing tools in the gaming industry, milieu, Gautam Ramdurai, that's my attempt at his name. I'm so sorry if I'm butchering it. Really kicks people in the pants with a bunch of stats about the gaming industry that maybe you might not have known. And so I think it'll be a good frame for our discussion today to put these out on the table. And if people haven't read this, let them know some of this great data. And one thing that is no surprise to me as the parent of an 11-year-old, but might be a surprise to the world at large, is that Google and YouTube do their zeitgeist kinds of things at the end of the year and let you know what sort of year it was across their properties. On YouTube, the second most searched term was Minecraft. Bunch of other really interesting stats from YouTube. Several of their most subscribed, I think it was 8 of the 10 of the most subscribed channels on YouTube relate to gaming. PewDiePie, who does Let's Play videos, has more subscribers to his channel than the entire population of Canada. And then if we're talking dollars, we've got, of course, Twitch that was acquired last fall by Amazon, Let's Play streaming video oriented channel, acquired by Amazon for something like $1 billion. And as long as we're talking about $1 billion, and, you know, of course you have to hit $1 billion, they point out as well in this Google piece that video games, as far as revenue, are a powerhouse that you might not have realized. Not just on par with Hollywood blockbusters, but in some instances just blowing them away. And the example they give is Grand Theft Auto 5, which hit $1 billion in sales in its first week of release. When you compare that to the highest grossing Hollywood movie of last year, global grosses, that was Transformers Age of Distinction, it's made somewhat more than $1 billion in its entire 6 months of release. So we're talking about an industry that is not just, kids on their iPads downloading 99-cent games, and maybe it is partially that, and that's quite lucrative as well. But we're talking about some serious cultural penetration and a force in our world that I don't know if people necessarily recognize. This, again, as the mom of a kid that is right in the gaming demographic, up and coming gaming demographic, none of that is too surprising to me, but other people might find this eye-opening. Do you find yourself, Patrick, having to explain the significance of the gaming industry more and more, or are people starting to get it?
No, all the time. Mostly to my parents. They still don't understand how I make a living at this. But the games industry always likes to tout that it surpassed the Hollywood in revenue. That each iteration of Call of Duty is the largest entertainment launch in history, preceding last year's Call of Duty launch. Activision's very, very adept at doing that. It's a little bit of apples to oranges because, the game is, at least on that type of game, is a singular buy versus a repeatable experience of buying multiple movie tickets. And there's not as many downstream revenue opportunities for a game as there is with a film that's going to go to cable or you buy the DVD or free channels and everything. So it's a little bit of apples and oranges on that front. But yeah, it still goes to show that it's a huge industry. It's a $25 billion industry, I think, globally, hardware and software. So it's big money. And you have to explain that it's not kids in their basements playing, playing the next Grand Theft Auto. Only it's also everybody who's playing Candy Crush and everything in between. There's lots of things that are games, and the same way there's lots of things that are films and lots of things that are books.
Yeah, and it's also not just young kids and young boys like my son. Another tidbit they lead off with in this Google piece is that women are the largest video game playing demographic. Did you know that, Suzanne? Is it any surprise to you?
I actually knew that. I saw an article not too long ago that women in my age group outnumber teenage boys in terms of being gamers. And over the summer, I taught a camp that taught kiddos how to program games. And I love to tote that out whenever the boys were like, oh, you can't tell me how to program this. I'm like, oh, wait, actually, I can.
That's awesome. It's really good to hear. I do see my own experience with kids and games is I take my son to a gaming camp in the summertime that he just loves. It's one of the ID Tech camps. And it does seem to be still a really heavily young male demographic at those events, but maybe the word just hasn't gotten out yet. So it's good to know that that'll be changing. So we're talking about just enormous concentration of energy and ideas and people focused around games. We're also talking about legal considerations that are going to, if they haven't been enforced yet, they will be soon because the dollars on the table are just too much. I know, Mona, you gave a talk recently in the last couple of months. Loved the title of the talk. It was called Keep It Secret, Keep It Safe, about intellectual property concerns for video game developers. I don't want you to rehash your whole talk, but obviously this is something that you and Patrick are advising game developer clients on all the time. And I'm just wondering, it would be interesting to sort of get your take on the attitude toward IP protection in general. Do you feel like game developers are very much of the mind that they have to keep it secret, keep it safe these days, or is there more flexibility?
Well, as far as the title, that's actually a Lord of the Rings reference. So
yes,
just throwing that out there. but it's with regard to what developers should be doing, that title is also mostly in reference to the early stages of development. Releasing too much information whenever you don't have the necessary protections from, say, copyright, trademark, things like that, that keep it secret, keep it safe practice is kind of what puts it in the realm of a trade secret. And what trade secret can do is, so long as it has commercial value, and as long as you take measures to actually keep that information secret through confidentiality clauses, non-disclosure agreements, then you get some some limited protections to that information and to that content. So that's mostly what that was referring to. Are developers very good at that? No, because they want to get as much publicity to their title as possible. So they wind up releasing a lot of information that maybe they should keep closer to their chest. They wind up releasing that earlier than they should, or they get too excited whenever they're trying to sell it to publishers, and then there's the possibility of having them having that parts of their ideas taken from other parties. So it's kind of a bit of a splitting the baby situation. You kind of have to decide what information you want to release, what content you want to release, and what information you want to keep safe so that it can't be taken from you down the road.
All right. Well, that seems like a great segue into talking about some copyright considerations concerning video games. One thing that I think is just fascinating in this area is the whole realm of Let's Play videos. News this week is that Microsoft came out with its own set of rules for Let's Play videos. They are not alone in doing this. Several video game developers, rights holders have done similar, and it seems like the approach has been all over the map. Some, and Microsoft is in this camp, have allowed people to, have expressly given their blessing, as long as certain rules and guidelines are followed, for people that are making Let's Play videos to go ahead and monetize that. Most of the companies who grant express permission for this and publish guidelines for it are being very cautious about how their brands are being used, how their trademarks are being used, and set out a bunch of parameters. But if you're playing within those rules, you should be able to put your Let's Play videos out on platforms that monetize them, like YouTube or Twitch, and go ahead and build your Let's Play empire. But again, that is because certain of these companies, and Mojang has its own separate set of rules along these lines that Microsoft has inherited and not yet changed. So there are certain rules and parameters out there. But in the absence of working with a game where those kinds of rules are there for you to follow, you might well find yourself in the crosshairs of an angry gaming company. And wasn't it Nintendo, Suzanne, who decided that the revenue that YouTubers were making should really be its own?
Yeah, Nintendo has been all over the place, and they changed their rules depending on countries. There's one Asian country where Nintendo has allowed anyone using that specific country's video service to make videos without any limitations. And then Nintendo here on YouTube wants to take all of the revenue, but then now they're considering sharing revenue. So I think as a longer running developer, they're trying to balance the needs of the modern world with what they know for protecting IP from back in the day when we were getting cartridges.
Mm-hmm. So, Patrick, as you're looking at this landscape and clients are coming to you going, we have a game property. We love that people are increasing interest in the game by making these Let's Play videos, but we're concerned about the fact that they are, some of them, building empires on our intellectual property. Do you have, you know, without disclosing client confidences, how do you help them work through those issues?
Well, it really depends on what they're trying to achieve. I mean, I think a lot of folks, you know, you're trying to balance the visibility that you're getting from the game, you know, versus the potential of you know, any sort of copyright infringement. And, you know, they just have to look at that and decide what their goal is. You know, establishing the rules like Microsoft has is really not a difficult process, but that's really ultimately more of a business call first than it is a legal issue and how you implement it.
Mona, do you have any other ideas about Let's Play and your clients' approach toward it?
Actually, one of my clients, Level Up Labs, is a pretty strong supporter of Let's Play because it serves as a great promotional vehicle for independent games. You have services like our podcast or video cast of like Giant Bomb, which is a great example. Something that you have to keep in mind is that, you know, I hate pulling the fair use card because you can never actually say that something is 100% fair use. It's an affirmative defense. So and what I mean by an affirmative defense is that you can't use it until you go to court. So you want to avoid that situation either as a developer or as the YouTuber. But as far as, you know, what I would, you know, what I've been discussing with Lars from Level Up or what I've been discussing with any of my other clients and Let's Play, it's that, you know, to the point where you can get your community involved and get them excited about your product, you should. There are going to be limitations, of course. So we work with a lot of terms of service and community guidelines with regard to that. And it's just kind of making it fit, making it work for the developer in whatever way we can. Saying absolutely no to Let's Play, I mean, it's going to be tricky to do because there's the question of whether or not it will constitute fair comment, fair use, use of the trademark in review. But ultimately, we want to make it work for the developer where we can.
So I've done a little reading on this in advance of the show, and there are some great articles in our discussion points that talk about the different policies that companies have come down with. I think Activision is one of the ones that might not have an express policy, certainly hasn't said it's okay to do the Let's Play videos. And it recently, to your point of fair use, Mona, got in trouble, or Activision didn't get in trouble, but came into the spotlight for issuing copyright takedown notices on Let's Play videos that highlighted glitches and problems in Call of Duty Advanced Warfare. Whereas perhaps there would be other videos that would be complementary to the game that were allowed to stay up, these ones that were complaining about issues were the ones that were getting targeted. And that's sort of the danger of the way our copyright law is structured, right, Suzanne? That companies can be inconsistent in their approach. And what it's going to take is someone who has made such a critical video to actually take a stand and say, okay, I may not be expressly authorized to do this, but this is fair use. And I'm certainly, you know, not only giving commentary and criticism on the game, but providing a public service. People should know that these problems exist. Do you know, Suzanne, of anyone in the Call of Duty Activision crosshairs who decided to take a stand?
I haven't seen anything on the legal front. People go on websites, Gamasutra, Kotaku, and mention that this is happening and that it's really bad, and everyone gets really riled up. But that just gives Activision some bad press for a couple of weeks, and then we all go back and buy Activision games anyway. So until someone actually goes to court and uses that as a defense, which would take Activision actually filing suit, I don't think we're going to have a definitive one way or another out of this.
Right. I love that I've had the opportunity now, and I encourage folks to check them out and compare them, to read through the Minecraft rules for Let's Play video that predated Microsoft's acquisition. They're very conversational and respectful of the users. They're very clear about Minecraft's rights, but it is the opposite of legalese. So it's interesting to read that and compare it to the Microsoft rules that just came out. Substantively, they're not that different. It's just kind of a different approach, as you might expect, because Mojang was quite a different company. Patrick, do you have any take on how these things should be presented and whether it makes a difference if you're writing in traditional legal boilerplate or in more clear and comprehensible language?
Yeah, no, I always prefer writing or reading things like that, like privacy policies and you know, consumer facing documents that are written, you know, written more conversationally, because I think, you know, we deal with so much of the whereas, pursuant to clause, whatever, in the, you know, the agreements that we do in our normal life. I think those are a little bit refreshing. I think you have to sort of write to your audience a little bit on that front. So yeah, I enjoy that.
So one of the things, even for the companies who expressly allow people to monetize Let's Play videos, it seems pretty common in those policies that you just don't get to have a free-for-all with the gaming company's intellectual property. And they do put some content restrictions in. They don't want obscenity. They don't want super, super violent things. Do you have any problem with that, Suzanne?
Yes and no. On the creative side of things, I love for people to come out with things that are interesting and different. And when you put those restrictions, you're obviously going to be cutting off some of that. But it is owned by the company, and they have an interest in making sure that it has a particular vision, a particular public-facing front. So if a video where Mickey Mouse is beheading Donald Duck becomes really popular, Disney's going to get really upset because that's not the kind of image they want for Mickey Mouse. They want Mickey Mouse to be kid-friendly and positive and family-facing. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense to put those kinds of restrictions depending on the content you're using. I couldn't see something like Grand Theft Auto saying, oh, we don't want any violence if you make Let's Plays using our game, because that wouldn't make sense based on what they're doing with their own content.
So that's, again, Mona, where fair use would kick in, right? If a company has a policy in place that says, you know, we're okay with this as long as you don't do these certain things, and someone does decide that Mickey Mouse beheading Donald Duck is what the particular work of art that they wanted to convey, then they'd have to make that case under the fair use doctrine, right?
Well, I mean, it depends. And that's the thing, is that it's not just, I mean, you don't just have one arrow in your quiver whenever you're a developer, whenever you're a content owner. So, I mean, you own the copyright, you own the trademarks, things like that. You have a lot of different things that you can use to counter that entire fair use defense. And that's something that, you know, we have to advise clients of frequently. That's the basis of protecting your portfolio. That's why I was saying, you know, you have to use fair use with caution. It is an affirmative defense. It's not an absolute defense by any stretch of the imagination. We don't really have a clear definition of everything that fair use can cover or what fair comment can cover for trademark. So you can't rely on it. I mean, and for a developer, you want to make sure that people don't rely on it too frequently. You want to be able to have control over your content to the extent you can. So, as I said, it depends. I mean, you can raise it, but is it in everybody's best interest to raise it? I'm not really sure.
Right. Suzanne, do you really think that Let's Players out there are taking a look at these policies and trying to comply with them, or does it just sort of come up after the fact when they get in trouble?
Oh, I guarantee you that almost no one actually knows what the policy says. you click agree when you buy the game, and then you click agree when you start your streaming software, and you have no idea what you've just agreed to. The problems arise when you get that letter from the developer, and you have to be like, oh, hey, so there's a problem here. I did something wrong. Let me call someone to retroactively look at what I did wrong, or let me try and dig through this sometimes massive agreement I have and see what exactly I'm in trouble for.
Right. The other thing I think we have to discuss in discussing Let's Play videos is there's sort of copyright concern on top of copyright concern involved here, because not only are Let's Players using the game itself as the platform for their video, you know, playing through it, showing their strategies, giving commentary, etc., but oftentimes, particularly in the case of second most popular YouTube search, Minecraft, what they're highlighting in their video are the mods that have been made of the game. And again, Minecraft has authorized a lot of those mods, but there are restrictions there too. And one of the things in the Minecraft EULA when discussing, you know, how you can mod the game, is that you are supposed to make your own creative work and not incorporate logos and trademarks and characters and things that are copyrighted by third parties. And that you actually, there is an indemnification provision in there that, here I'll read it to you. If you post content on our game and we get challenged, threatened, or sued by someone because the content infringes that person's rights, we may hold you responsible, and that means you may have to pay us back for any damages we suffer as a result. Therefore, it is really important that you only make content available that you have created, and you don't do so with any content created by anyone else. Of course, all the people who have created Minecraft mods for anything you can imagine, things we've talked about already, Call of Duty, Disney, SpongeBob, Harry Potter. There's a Minecraft mod for just about everything. I asked my son this morning if there was one for Adventure Time, and he said, oh, yep, absolutely. So a lot of the Let's Play videos feature those mods. So they not only feature the game, but then the intellectual property that Minecraft has not authorized its users to make mods consisting of. What do you think of that thorny issue, Patrick?
I don't know. I see both sides of it. I'm on the fence on that. I'm on where to go.
Okay, because it seems to me like, and again, I get some of my good information on this from my son and his friends who I was interviewing in the car before the show. And I was asking them about mods and how important it is to them to actually have familiar content in something like a Minecraft mod. Do you care if it's an Adventure Time mod or not? Do you like seeing your familiar characters there? And the take I got from them was that, yeah, it's fun and interesting. The take I got from them is how important the transformative nature is of the mod, that it's fun to see their familiar characters doing things those characters would not otherwise do. So again, the beheading of Mickey concern, or the beheading of Donald concern, comes in again. Perhaps they're doing things that their creators would be not on board with. So I do think that we're into an interesting area here that will wind up in court at some point, and I'm just wondering when. Suzanne, what do you think about the double copyright nature of Let's Play videos concerning mods?
Well, Mojang and now Microsoft are very smart to protect themselves from this. It seems to me, like you said, a lot of the players of this game are kids, and that means that a lot of the people making mods are also children. So that brings up yet another legal issue of, are you really going to go after the 13-year-old over the fact that they made this Disney mod for Minecraft? I also like to think that Minecraft is the Legos of this generation. And I grew up with a fair amount of licensed Lego sets. Star Wars and everything else. And it just came out. And it seems like Microsoft is trying to do that with Minecraft. I was on my Xbox earlier today and I saw the Simpsons pack is now available on Minecraft. So it seems like they are going the licensed route and the legitimate route, but maybe they're not producing content fast enough. And unlike where I couldn't make Lego figurines that were spot on of the TV shows I didn't get Legos for, it's much easier to create that in a digital universe. So it might be responsiveness. Mojang should definitely be protecting themselves this way, though, because there is a lot of it happening.
Right. As far as the economic value of the mod, another thing that seems true is that they have a lot of value in the Let's Play universe, and perhaps more value than they even have to players who want to download and play them. That there's maybe more appeal even to watching someone play through a mod rather than putting it on your system yourself and playing through it. That it's just sort of fun to know the mod exists. It's great to see how it goes, but when it comes to, oh, you know, I'm now downloading some third-party software, it's going to take up perhaps a ton of space. I'm not going to know if it's secure. I'm not going to know if I'm, you know, getting a virus. I'm not going to know if it's going to work when I download it. So I think, you know, at least among the demographic I get to observe on a daily basis, watching the mods be played is almost more valuable and fun than playing through themselves. So, you know, yet another consideration on the Let's Play side. Mona, any thoughts on that?
I mean, as far as economic value, I mean, that's kind of the most important factor that we need to look at. It's the content owner's right to benefit from that economic value. I mean, under mm-hmm. copyright law, that's the principle behind copyright law and behind intellectual property law in general. It's just giving people an opportunity to financially benefit from their creations. And that includes derivative works, which is exactly what a mod is. So I think that in an ideal world, people who create mods would be able to work with the content owners in order to develop that third-party software. And I think that's what Microsoft is trying to do. That's what a lot of people who put out mods for their own content try to do. But that's not a perfect world. We don't live in a perfect world, so there's always going to be conflict with regard to that. And it just comes down to, is the content owner, is Disney, is Marvel, are these people going to view this as a commercial benefit? Is this going to be promotional for them? Is this something that they can get in on and kind of work with the person who's creating it? Or is this something that they need to actively defend against? Is this something that they need to put a stop to? So as far as the economic interest, I mean, that's the only thing that really matters in all of this to a lot of people. I mean, a lot of content owners aren't really concerned too much about integrity. Many of them are, but ultimately it comes down to the bottom line. It comes down to money.
Right. Having control over your popular video game was certainly important in the case of Flappy Bird. Everybody remembers the saga of this game last year. We have some news on the Flappy Bird front. Apparently, there's going to be, even though Flappy Bird was pulled down from the iTunes store publicly and famously, it is now going to come out as a life-sized arcade game. Which would be really fun to have, you know, even if you didn't have an arcade. I could certainly see one doing well in our studio there in Petaluma and distracting all our staff. So it seems like Dong Nguyen, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, aside from pulling the game from iTunes, has other ideas and other licensing in mind for his very popular game. The other platform that it is available on in a fully authorized and licensed way is the Android smartwatch universe, which seems like a very different kind of experience playing on a little watch versus playing on a big arcade game. But Flappy Bird is still flapping, apparently. Suzanne, can you add anything to this for us?
Flappy Bird, I I don't get it. And I should probably not admit that on a recorded show. But it's been really interesting to watch the rise and then disappearance and then all of the clones that came out of nowhere. And then there was briefly a series of letters sent out from someone that held the trademark on the word Flappy in games. And but they held it prior to Flappy Bird becoming a thing and never pursued the Flappy Bird directly creator, just the clones, and never actually went to court over it and just kind of died off on that. And now to see it back again, it's like the one thing that just won't go away.
Let's talk about the clones, Patrick. How do you handle it when a client's game is popular and is subject to a bunch of clones that want to capitalize on its success?
Well, this isn't really a new concept at all. Mm-hmm. What's happened is the rise of mobile and tablet games and the short production times for them has just made it more prevalent, right? This is something that, 10 years ago, if you really wanted to make a Grand Theft Auto clone, you could. It would just take you 2 years and millions of dollars. So you kind of had the marketplace to yourself on a particular style or look or genre. But cloning happened then. What happens now is if something really cool comes out, you can iterate on it and clone it in weeks or months. So hundreds of other people are doing it because it's an open playing field. So we see it more. I think from how we approach it from a transactional end, when you're working in a production collaboration kind of environment, you have to deal with your reps and warranties about who's creating it, whether it's original, your indemnifications, about whose responsibility it is if you're cloning something else that I'm funding, for example, I'm going to get sued. Well, that's not what I signed up for. So from a transactional side, you handle it that way. And then obviously from a litigation side, which we don't handle at our firm, there's a lot of other aspects, whether it's cease and desist, and moving up the ladder. But there's plenty of cases out there. Zynga with everything Ville related certainly took that position that anything like that out there was a clone. But it's like I said, this goes back a long, long time. I mean, years ago, when I was working for a company that was doing a Lord of the Rings game based on the books, we got a letter from the company who's making the Lord of the Rings games based on the movies saying that our wizard as depicted looked too much like their wizard. Well, the wizard was wearing a pointy gray hat and had a long beard in both. And theirs was based on the book, which they had rights to. So, this is not a new phenomenon. Now that's obviously a singular expression rather than the whole game, but the concepts are pretty much the same. You won't see these litigations going away anytime soon.
Right. And on the legal front, maybe you could remind us, I know we've talked about it on the show before, but for anybody who might have missed those previous episodes, there is some legal latitude here. You can copy a game's mechanics with impunity, right?
Yeah, I mean, mechanics are not protectable in the same way that the expression is, right? Copyright doesn't cover the mechanics. Copyrights covers the expression. So, but where that line is between the expression and the mechanic is often really tough to figure out or to delineate. And that sometimes, unfortunately, only happens at court. And sometimes you can muddy the waters on some of those as well. So just getting into court sometimes is a victory for some people.
In some of the recent coverage of Flappy Bird and what it's doing now, I read that the creator or whoever he is working with to manage the game has attempted to patent the game. Is this something you see commonly?
We don't. Again, we're not dealing in patent prosecution. At our firm, and software patents are a bit dicey in general. And generally disfavored under the current environment, but it's just one of the areas that people are always looking at to protect their IP, whether it's copyright, trademark, patent, trade secret and trade dress. I mean, whatever works, it's they're trying to achieve a goal and using whatever legal protections that they can.
All right, any thoughts, Ray? Clones, Mona.
Again, another tricky issue. When I first started practicing law, a big chunk of my practice was cease and desist letters based on clones for apps and on both the iPhone and the Android market. So as far as, success rate on how to handle it from a developer perspective or from, you know, one of our clients' perspective, you have two options. You can confront the cloner directly, or you can target the marketplace itself and send a takedown notice. And you see mixed success, you know, doing both. You can get the person who's making the clone to take it down on his own, which kind of keeps you from having to go through the process of and the risk of putting up a takedown notice. You have to keep in mind that whenever you put up send in a takedown notice, you might subject yourself to a declaratory judgment action. There's some case law substantiating that claim. So once you send in that takedown notice, the person that you're trying to take down can actually file a lawsuit against you under a declaratory judgment action saying, we want the law to say that this is okay. So it kind of forces your hand. So you take that risk whenever you start sending in those takedown notices. And that's something that we always have to advise clients on.
And you also, adding on to what Mona was saying, you also have to look at some of the background of it. I mean, again, whether it violates the letter of the law is one thing, but you're also sort of painting a picture, I think, from a plaintiff side of a potential case. You know, you look at the situation with Yeti Town and Triple Town, where I don't know if the audience is familiar with that, but
so why don't you tell us, Patrick?
Yeah, so Triple Town was a game which, you know, was sort of a match three game, and it was a fun little game, and they went under an NDA with another company to say, you know, take a look at this game, maybe you'll publish it for us. The company they went under the NDA with took a look at it, had access to all the codes, saw the game, played all the way through the game, said, no, we're not going to publish it. We're not going to pay you to work on this game. And by the way, 2 weeks later, they came out with a game called Yeti Town, which was the exact same thing, set in a snow environment, match three, et cetera. And the fact that they were talking to them and they were under NDA and they had access to the code, came into the litigation, and it made the situation worse. Regardless of looking at what was copyrightable or what was protectable or not, the access made them a little bit of a bad actor, and the case ultimately settled with the Yeti Town guys giving up all of the Yeti Town IP and giving it over as part of the settlement. So we don't know actually how it would have turned out, but you can't overlook the background and the factual situation that goes with this, because if you're painting a pretty grim picture, it's not going to look too good.
So just as an aside, I'm wondering how many, of course, a lot of games are played on computer and other devices now, but I'm wondering if your offices are littered with arcade games.
We have our fair share of games here, but not to the arcade level. We wouldn't get any work done.
Yeah, I guess that's a testament to how long ago I was in law school. When I've told this story on the show before, but I have to tell it to you guys because it's right in context just with what we're discussing. That one of my assignments as a summer associate at Manat Phelps, one of all of our assignments as a summer associate at that West LA law firm way back in the day when I was in law school, was to go down into the basement of the building of Manat's offices. And there were a couple of arcade video games set up that was a similar kind of situation where I think that the lawsuit involved allegations that information had been shared under an NDA. And then a very similar game came out from the party who was supposedly barred, but this was an arcade game. And we were supposed to play the two games and note any similarities and differences so that it helped the analysis of prosecuting the claim. So, I guess summer associates can still look forward to that kind of assignment, but it might be on a different platform.
I don't think clients want to see you bill them for playing their games, though.
Yeah, you know, I don't think they probably billed that time. let's see. Let's move on to another area that is sort of a legal gray area for the gaming industry. Very popular thing for people to do when games are no longer being actively marketed, when they're very nostalgic for people who played them in their youth, is to find a way to play older games on an emulator. So there's still plenty of market value involved and rights held by someone, usually, although there's the abandoned game problem as well. But game emulators technically aren't legal, are they, Patrick?
No, you run into the same problem. I mean, those rights and that intellectual property belongs to somebody. So if you're monetizing it and it doesn't belong to you, then obviously there's an issue there. Whether, you know, if they're abandoned games and that IP holder doesn't know it's occurring, you might be getting away with it, but that doesn't mean that you're in the right.
Right. So, Suzanne, along these lines, what do you think of the EFF's exemption request? They've filed a number of them. One of them relates to how you can, they're asking the Copyright Office to give people an exemption from circumvention liability under the DMCA if you are going to remove digital locks, et cetera, protections, DRM, on games so that they will play after a developer has stopped supporting them. So you've bought the game. It's old enough that the developer either has abandoned it or is not paying attention to it anymore. And you still want to play, but the only way you can go about doing that is if you do something that would otherwise be illegal under the DMCA. Have you looked at this at all, Suzanne?
I have. I think the EFF does some really great things and they work for really good purposes, but I don't see this actually happening. For several reasons. One, if there were enough people who really wanted to play one of these games that are no longer supported, I feel like the company would allow support or would give a newer version so that those people could be monetized. It's just good business to do that. And allowing them to have this previous option and not move on and not be monetized is something that companies are inherently against. Also, I don't know that many companies would, given the few number of people that are still playing these old versions, see this as a big enough threat to go after it. It's obviously illegal under the DCMA. That's why the EFF is trying for the exemption. But if there are 10 kids with a server somewhere that are playing a game that's no longer supported, I don't see any of the big guys coming down on it too hard because they're only losing 10 sales. It's when it gets up into those big numbers that you're going to start having issues. So I don't think it's really going to go anywhere in terms of their exemption request.
But they're not even losing sales on old games, right? It's not even something that's actively on the market anymore.
They're kind of losing sales because a lot of these games are from franchises. They mentioned Need for Speed and Mario Kart in the article online. If you're playing the old Need for Speed on a server your friend has, you're not buying the new Need for Speed for the new server. So in that way, they're losing income.
Or maybe you just really like the old game.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. There are some good old games that I still play. Right now, Wolfenstein and Portal are at the top of my list, but they're both single player, so I don't have the server issue.
Right. All right. Well, I think we should take a break for a moment before we jump into the relationship between gaming and Hollywood. Before we do that, we have a sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law that I would love to bring your attention to. And that is FreshBooks this week. As you might know, FreshBooks is a cloud accounting software that's designed from the ground up for businesses, entrepreneurs, and it's actually perfect for attorneys. I use it in my practice all the time. In fact, it's how I make sure that when I'm doing work for clients, I accurately account for the time that I'm spending, generally not playing video games and comparing one side by side to another. That's not the kind of thing that generally gets billed through. But when I'm doing things more substantive for them, I need to know how much time is being spent. I need to accurately and nicely format it into a presentation that lets them understand exactly what I was doing and what they're paying for. And then I need to conveniently get it out and get myself paid. That's what accounting software and billing software is all about, right? So FreshBooks just makes this part of my even smaller law practice than Mona's and Patrick's. go seamlessly. I don't need an accountant. I don't need an assistant. FreshBooks takes care of all that for me. And I just can't tell you how nice it is to be able to know that I'm able to have a solo law practice and have it handled so professionally. So you can use the software for tracking your time, as I mentioned. It really will grow with your business. So if you might just have a handful of clients starting out, FreshBooks is going to be able to handle your capacity as you grow. And it's going to help you grow because you're going to get paid on an average of 5 days faster, they've found, using their product. You don't need Word or Excel or cobbling together some kind of invoice or spreadsheet. FreshBooks does all that for you. It looks very professional. It's very quick. And you also, you know, nothing's worse than that awkward reminder to a client when it's been a while and you haven't been paid. You can actually set up FreshBooks to automate that process. And I think that, you know, just a little tickler to a client sometimes is received a lot better than you getting on the phone and dunning them. So that's built in for it too. You can set up recurring profiles, put your automatic billing right on autopilot. Just, you know things that you're doing every month for a client, and you're going to bill for that on a consistent basis. You don't even need to pay attention to it. It'll just, you can set it up like a macro almost, and it'll just go out for you. You're going to spend less time on paperwork. You're going to free up, they've found, up to 2 days a month to focus on all the other things related to your business, all the things that don't relate to that sort of boring time and billing facet of it. It's also going to help you keep track of your own expenses. You can snap photos of receipts right from your phone to instantly capture those expenses. And then when they're reimbursable, pass those through to a client. You can instantly access complete financial reports so you can keep track of expenses and be ready for tax time right around the corner here. And it's going to integrate with what you're already using. It integrates with all kinds of applications like Google Apps, PayPal, Stripe, MailChimp, Fundbox, Zen Payroll, and more. And if you ever need help, I've never needed help with the software. It just works right and works great. And I've never had to call up customer service. But if something ever goes awry for you, you're going to talk to a real person every time you call, and support is free forever. So you've got to try it. FreshBooks is free right now with no obligation when you're a listener to This Week in Law. All you need to do is go to freshbooks.com/twill. Don't forget to enter This Week in Law in the How Did You Hear About Us section, and you're going to get 30 days for free, no strings attached at all. And thanks so much, FreshBooks, for extending our listeners that offer and for supporting This Week in Law. All right. Well, we were already talking about some tie-ins of media properties with games. Let's go there. Let's take a trip to Hollywood. So this is up the alley of IE Law Group, correct? You guys engage in licensing, negotiating licenses for games who want to work with well-known people and or well-known properties and incorporate them into games?
Yeah, this is definitely something that we've done a lot of in the past and are still doing a lot of.
And I'm curious, because there are games that are very closely tied to something well-known and popular culturally from TV or movies, and there are games that are not. Do you see any... you know, anecdotally, do you see any better strategy to pursue from a business standpoint?
Well, it really just sort of depends on the property and what kind of game you're making. I mean, there's plenty of obscure properties that that probably would make a great game, but the question is the valuation. What are you going to value that license at when really what you need it for is the audience recognition, right? It's easy to go out and make, you know, a video game based on the next Avengers. Everybody knows that the next Avengers movie is coming out, and they're probably going to see the game and see the movie and at least look at the game or think about the game. But you still have to figure out a way to make a compelling product there. Whereas if you do something obscure without the audience built into it that's already there, then I guess the question is, what are you paying for? So it becomes a valuation issue.
Hasn't there always been kind of a problem? You would think that a game that was tied to a movie or a TV show would benefit a lot just from that recognition, but you've got to make a great game too. Hasn't there been sort of a gap there?
There's been a huge gap there, and we could probably do an entire episode on that, to be honest with you. And that's usually boils down to the production time for a lot of these games. By the time the movie gets greenlit and the movie company decides that they're going to license it out and has their sort of parade of people who would potentially come in and bid on these rights, and then the contract process there, and then that game licensee spitting up the game production, you've wasted months of time. And that's the one thing you can't get back in the production is that time. And if you're trying to then get a game out in half the time that it takes the movie to get made, well, you're going to have usually a pretty substandard game. And that's been sort of historically borne out.
So do you feel like Hollywood is starting to recognize this and you know, following a series of unsuccessful movie tie-in games, are they starting to clue in?
Well, definitely. And unsuccessful might not be the right term. Mm-hmm. They're unsuccessful critically, but a lot of these games will still do really well, particularly kids' games and the animated genre. They'll still do really well commercially, and they'll accomplish the goal. But I do think that most of the studios have gotten a little bit more savvy on that over the years, and particularly now if they're licensing games for mobile and tablet. It's an entirely different exercise, right? And you can look at some of the games that Kabam has done, with The Hobbit, and I think they did the Godfather game there, and I know they did the Hunger Games because we were involved in that license, so they're able to make a mobile game, iterate on it quickly, and still make it out in time for the next movie, and in some cases maybe they're trying to do it outside of the movie, and there is no launch tie-in, which helps a lot as well, which solves that problem. Mobile has reinvigorated this. I'm sorry, mobile has definitely reinvigorated the license business a little bit.
Well, I'm going to seize on a phrase you just used, launch time, and make that our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We're coming up on California's MCLE compliance deadline, and I assume other states do it about this time every year too. We put these passphrases in the show if you are listening to hopefully claim continuing legal education or other professional education credit wherever you may be in the U.S. or elsewhere. A lot of jurisdictions would like you to be able to demonstrate that you've actually listened to or watched the show. So we put a couple of phrases in to help you show that after the fact. And our first one for this show is going to be launch time. Suzanne, do you think that games tied to TV or movie or I guess also we could build in books, which, you know, if a book has been successful, there's probably been a movie made out of it anyway. So we might be talking about the same universe of properties. Do you think that there's been progress on the game development side for those kinds of games?
Oh, absolutely. I saw in the chat someone brought up E.T. the game, and I laughed to myself a bit because part of it is that we're recognizing that games are a separate form of expression that are trying to tell different stories, and the games are no longer necessarily a rehatching of what you saw in the theater. Part of it is that we're finally getting to where technology makes people that have expectations, having seen a movie and having seen the characters on the screen, align better with what you get in the game. But there were also fantastic games before. I was thinking of Aladdin. When I was little, I used to go over to my friend's house and we would spend just hours playing the Aladdin game, and it was fantastic.
For our video viewers,
yeah.
E.T. the game is now just wandering across the screen.
It's physically terrible. Like everyone, that is the game you go to when you're talking about bad games. But there have been bad Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle games. It's really down to the development team and whether or not they realize that this is a different medium. We're trying to tell a different story, but we're relating it back to this other content, and we need to respect that too.
Mona, with this sort of specter out there that perhaps the game development side of these Hollywood properties has not always lived up to its potential. Is that something that you guys see on the transactional side? Do you see the rights holders trying to build in stipulations or requirements that the game be of a certain quality?
It's kind of difficult to predict something like that. So on the whole, it's not something that you see a lot in warranties. You can't warrant the success or the failure of a game. You can, you know, you can make it up to commercial and technical standards. You can have approval rights over what's going to be released, but how the audience is going to accept it. I mean, if you want a successful game to come out as a content owner, you need to give the developer time to make it. It's like Patrick said, the biggest problem that you have is that you have unreasonable development cycles where the developer just does not have time to put out a premium product. So it's, and like Patrick said, you know, mobile has kind of reinvigorated this market because you can put out a really, really slick, nice looking mobile game based on an existing IP in a very short amount of time. So, so to that end, you know, you might have a little more freedom to make sure that the product you're putting out is going to have more commercial success. If you want a game with critical acclaim based on an existing franchise or a movie franchise, look at like the Batman series. You know, they have a lot of time to develop it. They have a lot of time to kind of, or the most recent Lord of the Rings game. It became a project in and of itself. You know, the game itself took a life, it took on a life of its own apart from the property. And I think that's actually, it kind of reinvents the franchise, and it kind of, I think it makes for better quality games.
Is that the Shadow of Mortar game?
Yep, Shadow of Mortar. Thank you.
Which is done really well, right?
Yeah.
And Denise, you know, echoing on what Mona said, years ago, a couple of the movie studios tried to build in metrics or penalties if the game quality wasn't there or if it didn't sell well enough. But to me, that was always sort of a strange argument to make because they're the ones who are proving the direction of creatively of the game. So they're telling you, they're telling the game company, you know, don't do this, don't, you know, do this, tell the story this way, and then punishing the game company when that story didn't resonate with the consumer. So so that argument sort of folded in on itself and thankfully has more or less gone away. I mean, it's you have to be on the same page and collaborate between the property owner and the game company, but it's really hard to mandate a quality bar.
Right. Yeah, I could see where that would be. Another area, a very popular culture area that has a lot of crossover with games is sports. And we've talked a lot about issues with sports players who hopefully what happens in the best case scenario for a game developer, if they're going to make a sporting game, is they go to all of the players and all of the franchises that they want to use in the game, and they make sure they've got all their licensing lined up. But EA has been in litigation with various NFL players in the news this week, is that that case is going to be able to go ahead and go forward, that the players in the game are significantly close to former players' name, and well, it's certainly not their name, but their likeness, a realistic virtual simulation of someone that you might recognize. So EA has been fighting this, and this case is now going to advance, and it's certainly not the same, the first of these kinds of cases that we've seen. Do you think that they will begin to diminish and people will start reaching out and saying, okay, if we're going to make someone who looks like Terry Bradshaw, we're going to need Terry Bradshaw's permission, Patrick?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an area that we're paying attention to. I mean, we're not necessarily, you know, deeply involved with it with this case, but I think what it does is it shows that companies are going to need to make sure that the rights they're getting are complete, right? And You know, sports is a bit of a different beast because there's so many rights that you have to get, and you get them through the, you know, through the league and through the union in some cases. But you see what EA backed off of their college game for some of these same issues with the NCAA. But I think what it boils down to from the transactional side, again, if you're representing the developer's got to make sure that the rights are actually held by the company that's purporting to give them to you or license them to you to make the game. And sports is really unique in that the player likeness, the player bio, obviously the player statistics do drive sales, whereas you don't necessarily need Harrison Ford's voiceover to be, you know, have a successful Indiana Jones game, right? You can have somebody else's voice, the character can look pretty similar, obviously, like we talked about with the Lord of the Rings and Gandalf, but you don't necessarily need the talent involvement in the same way that you probably do for sports. So it's more important there.
Right. Well, I guess that answers another of my questions for you on the show today. And we've obviously been paying attention to here on this week, and you guys probably have too, the Garcia versus Google case in the Ninth Circuit, where Google is being sued, and that case was held to be able to go forward. The Ninth Circuit is now rethinking that, and we might have a ruling out on that soon. But Cindy Lee Garcia basically was duped into acting in the movie Innocence of the Muslims. And claimed a copyright in her own performance that would entitle her to request removal of that movie from YouTube. This has been really controversial because if an actress has a copyright in her own performance, that begins to wreak havoc with who gets control over a property once it's done. And I'm wondering if this might become an issue for the gaming industry as well. What do you think, Patrick?
Well, I think it touches on an issue for the games industry, right? And it also touches back on an issue we talked about early in the show about, you know, trade secrets and protecting them that Mona mentioned. A lot of the smaller entities in the space are moving fast, and they're moving in a lean capacity, and they're not always necessarily tying up all the loose ends. And this is definitely a loose end. Any contributor to the game, whether it's an actor or a voiceover talent, whether it's a writer, whether it's a coder, you have the same issues, you know, with the people that are writing code for you. You have to make sure that you have the rights to the work product, whether you have them under license or whether you have them in an ownership capacity. You still need to cover off on all those loose ends, and smaller companies don't always think about it that way. And I think this is a good example of it. I don't know if this particular instance of this case is going to have an impact on games, but I think I think it definitely illustrates the problem that game companies face.
So your preference would be for clients that you're consulting with is just they cross every T and dot every I and just assume that maybe somebody is going to be able to assert some sort of ownership interest that could wreak havoc with the game developer's ability to control whatever it is they develop, right?
If every T is crossed and every die is dotted, theoretically you won't have these issues, right?
Right.
Somebody could assert something, and then you've got it covered. You've got backup for it. You've got the rights to the music. You've got ownership of the code that was created for you on a contract basis. The voiceover talent that came in and spent a day, isn't going to assert any copyright infringement on their performance, right? All of that could theoretically be covered with a well thought out plan. It's just that a lot of game developers are focusing on creating and getting their game to market, and they don't always focus on some of those details in the way that I would like.
Yeah. Well, back to the sports arena and name and likeness issues. I'm afraid we've got bad news for you, Suzanne. I know you were probably looking forward to playing Glorious Leader, the game where Kim Jong-un was going to be assisted by the ghost of his father and also Dennis Rodman in fighting the evil forces of the U.S. It looks like not only Dennis Rodman came out and said, no, I'm going to sue over this. You can't use my name and likeness and sent a demand letter shot across the bow. But now, according to the game maker, their website was hacked and they're not going to release the game. So I'm sorry, Suzanne.
A little bit heartbroken, not going to lie. Yeah. I love the humor in games, and that's just such a perfect example of that kind of humor, that irreverent experience that you can only get in games. But I knew from seeing it that it was just going to be riddled with issues from the very beginning, and the timing on it was just terrible with everything that happened to Sony. So you win some, right, you lose some.
Yeah, the coverage of it, people seem to be looking askance at the game developer and saying, really, you got hacked? That's kind of convenient, just when you had an unsuccessful run at funding the game via Kickstarter. And they seem to be, their guess is that it was a copycat hacker modeling what happened to Sony and taking them down. They also say that they lost all their backups, all their code, etc. Does that seem like something that could happen, Suzanne?
I mean, I'm not really much of a developer. I'm working on a game right now, but it's not a project by any means that large. But I have backups on top of backups. And I feel like when you're investing that much time, and especially a project you're asking for $55,000 on, you'd have backups on top of backups and cloud saves and emails and things from which you would be able to rebuild it. It's a little convenient.
All right. Well, we're not saying anything. Just that the game's not available. Unfortunately, doesn't look like it will be. One thing that is a positive development this week, and I think we talked about this the last time you were on, Suzanne, is that there was a lot of controversy when Twitch decided to blank out the music in not in its live streams, but in videos that were available on demand after being recorded, if there was unlicensed, copyrighted music in the video, you would find yourself watching a silent video because the music was being muted. They're trying to work toward a situation where there's a universe of music that's available for people making videos on Twitch. They only have 500 titles right now available in this realm of usable music. It reminds me of back when podcasting got its start and people were recording pod-safe music specifically for use in that context. And it seems like that's the approach Twitch is trying to adopt as well. They're also hoping that because they already have musicians that are using their platform for marketing, that they can encourage those musicians to also make the music they're putting up there available for Let's Players and others to incorporate the music into their videos. What do you think of this approach, Suzanne?
I think it's clever. Twitch needs to cover themselves, and music is one of those industries where there is a lot going on in terms of copyright, particularly with all the piracy. We see a lot of it in the games industry too, Pirate Bay and all of that. So I think they're being smart about it. They're trying to give people options. I don't know that shutting down the music was necessarily the best initial response, but at least they're trying to fix it now.
Music is certainly one of those T's that needs to be crossed and I's that need to be dotted when developing a game. Mona, can you tell us how your clients try and deal with that problem?
Well, it's not really a problem. It's kind of part and parcel mm-hmm. with developing a game. You're always going to need sound. I actually, I've done some work with the Game Audio Alliance, which is a group of composers. So you come up against two models. You either get a straight work for hire deal or you get a license deal. And that's kind of how it is with any kind of content that you license for a game, mm-hmm. whether it be coding, et cetera. So I don't know. I can't really call it a problem.
Right.
It's just part of what you need to have. And as far as, you know, the composer agreements tend to be a bit more straightforward. They tend to be, especially if they're on a work for hire deal, you get the rights to pretty much all of the music. You may get paid in installments or you may get paid on a back end royalty based on the success of the game. if you just license the music straight out, it could be a non-exclusive or an exclusive license. There are a lot of iterations that sound and audio music itself can have in the context of game licensing.
Right. It seems like there are some games where recognizable music is super important. Rock Band kind of games. You can't really have one of those games without having songs that people know. And then on the other hand, you can do obscure or unknown or originally authored for the game kinds of music for other kinds of games. Patrick, anything along these lines you want to tell us?
I'm sorry, I was responding to somebody's comment on chat. Can you repeat that, Denise?
Sure. I'm talking about music and games, and yeah. You know, we were talking about the role of popular, recognizable movies and books and things in games before, and now I'm sort of shifting gears and thinking about that in the music sense. Yeah. There are some games like Rock Band and that sort of genre of game where you absolutely need to have certain very recognizable tracks. I'm remembering some of the dance games that came out when the Kinect first developed, how you needed to have those top hits for people to do their crazy dancing to. But there are other games where original music is perfectly fine or something more obscure or could give more public exposure to an artist that might have a niche audience like Jonathan Coulton with Portal.
Right.
Just wonder about your take on the intersection between music and games at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think like Mona said, it's just a reality that you're going to have to license your music, or you're going to have to account for it somehow, and make sure you have the rights. And it depends on the game, depends on what you're trying to make. Obviously, if you're going to make a James Bond game, you need the James Bond theme song, right? You can't. It'd be weird if you didn't have it. If you made Star Wars, you'd have to have that theme music with it, and you have to pay what the price is for that. But in other instances, original compositions are fine. And by the way, the original compositions are not cheap either. We've done some original composition deals for some of our clients that are making games. One of our clients is a company that was the creative team behind Flower, and they're making this game that's sort of heavy visuals and heavy sound and music design, and they're paying a premium for that. And that's just. That's just the reality, and you just have to factor that into the budget. It's no different than accounting for coders and engineers and artists and animators.
Got it. Hey, I wanted to shift gears. We were talking before about the language used in communicating rights and obligations related to games, and this caught my eye this week, and I wanted to get your guys' take on the waiver that people are being made to agree to if they download a free copy of Assassin's Creed Unity. Apparently there were some problems and glitches, and Ubisoft did sort of a, you know, well, we'll fix that. We'll make that good. The game, I guess, needed 4 patches in its first month. And so, and I know how popular that game has been, again, with the demographic that I see every day, my son and his friends. And none of them, I think, even know that they have the right to download a free game. But if they were to do it, they are now under the language, and it's this lengthy boilerplate that no one would really notice or pay attention to, that makes them agree that they're not going to participate in any class action against Ubisoft for, again, we were talking about guaranteeing the quality of the game. Apparently, Ubisoft is worried that it would be sued because it released a glitchy game, because they're making people sign away their rights to do just that. Suzanne, what do you think of this?
I've seen a couple of these suits come in and out where players upset that there wasn't online connectivity right at the launch time, or they didn't have all of the features that they were supposed to have, and they call up the government all angry, and they say, well, they lied to us in advertising, and it never seems to really go anywhere. Mm-hmm. So on the legal side, I don't necessarily know that a claim about the quality or the issues with the patches would go anywhere. I do think mm-hmm. it's a really good business decision to say, hey, here's a free game. let's not bring this up again. It's been happening with the Halo Master Chief Collection that I've been playing. They're now giving away a free game because of the numbers of issues in multiplayer. It seems like it's just the way things are going. But overall game quality, with the ability to constantly patch and not having to have that final gold master that you're sending out, it may be diminishing game quality, because they know that if there's an issue in week one, they can send out a patch online and everyone will be covered by it and it'll all be better. So it's an issue that's endemic in the industry now.
Do you know when, if you downloaded your free Halo universe game, that whether you were giving up your right to sue when you did that?
I don't think they've released it yet. They just said that it's coming. When they do, I'm definitely going to take a look at those terms.
Yeah, exactly. It sounds like maybe, even though, you know, initially when you look at this and see they're hiding some sort of gotcha in the legalese, as you were saying, Suzanne, it may be a way to enable game developers to iterate quickly and somewhat protect themselves from suit, to be less concerned about putting out something that's not absolutely perfect. And could that be a good thing?
I think it could be a good thing. We're in an age where there is a certain expectation of we're going to get the next Fallout next year or the next Half-Life, which will absolutely never happen. But theoretically, you have this expectation that you're going to get the next version of a game very quickly. And that expectation is putting this pressure on developers to produce more quickly. So there needs to be a certain degree of understanding, and that legal protection is definitely important for on the development side, to be able to give the consumer what they want, but still have the flexibility to fix it later.
And so, you know, adding on to that, we're a litigious society in general. And I think in some cases that's sad. In some cases it's warranted. Obviously protecting the consumer is a valid concern. But, you know, a free copy and a patch and a quality issue, that's not a legal problem. That's a customer service issue. And, I don't blame Ubisoft in that case for sort of, for preemptively shutting that end down. I think when you get into privacy issues and things along those lines, maybe the question is a little bit different or the impact's a little bit different. But there really shouldn't be a class action suit over a patched game and that you're getting for free. I mean, that just seems silly to me.
Okay, let's get into privacy issues and some other issues that relate to how lawmakers and regulators think about the gaming universe. So as with lots of other kinds of businesses that have a lot of information, credit card information, in the case of gaming platforms like the Xbox or PS4, those companies are going to know a whole lot about what your interests are, what your habits are, how much time you might be spending engaged in a leisure activity, all of these things that are sensitive on the privacy front. And I'm wondering, Patrick and Mona, how you think game developers are addressing those concerns.
Well, I'll start it, but certainly from a transactional side, perspective, it's something that both sides of a deal take very seriously. There are carve outs for limitations of liability for unlimited liability on potential privacy side matters in a lot of cases. It's definitely a strong area and a strong concern as far as the evaluation and the formulation of the policy. That's an area that Mona deals with more, I think, for our clients. So I'll kick it over to her on that.
Okay.
Yeah, following up with Patrick, another consideration from the transactional side is who owns the data and who can do what with it. So do both parties have access to that data? If so, how is that information going to be used? And then the next issue that we come up to is, you know, the privacy policy itself and conveying to the users how that information is going to be used. Being honest with the end user is the most important factor as far as law and policy. With regard to privacy policies, technically, under U.S. law, they are not required. It is really inadvisable to go that route. if you do have a privacy policy, and we strongly recommend that all of our clients do, the most important factor is to be 100% honest. And if there are any changes in your data collection or data sharing processes, make sure you convey those changes to your end users. That's the kind of it's never going to be fail safe, because there are always going to be data breaches. There are always going to be risks of security breaches, as we see with Sony, unfortunately, time and time again. But it is important to at least let your users know. And then the flip side of that is also protecting yourself. So if there are any issues with connectivity, if there are any data breaches, make sure your end users realize that you aren't necessarily going to be liable for those. And just keeping them informed. And going back to an earlier point, I think one of the biggest issues with regard to this, one of the biggest things that we really need to be mindful of, is making sure that the end user can actually understand what you're saying in your privacy policy. So to that extent, you know, that clear English requirement is really, really important.
And I think also important is for game developers, both on the hardware and software and platform side, to think, you know, to really think through how privacy comes into what it is they're doing. I think we're still kind of early days in figuring out all of the data, especially as, you know, platforms continue to develop and innovate and have new ways to interact with and record what you're doing, that maybe some of the stuff just hasn't hit people's radar yet. I remember, Suzanne, when the Kinect came out, and you know, whether it was on or off would be an issue, and you know, it might be watching you at times when you were not particularly aware of, and you know, there are just all kinds of ways in which gaming companies might have data about you, aren't there?
There are, and some of it is unintentionally collected. If you use code from a programmer that you hired out of town or even out of country, and they included some code to collect people's IP addresses, and maybe you as the primary developer don't realize that, so you didn't put it in your privacy policy. It's really knowing exactly what you're getting and when you're getting it and conveying that to the consumer, assuming the consumer actually reads the privacy policy, because a lot of players don't. But I mean, people will always be uncomfortable with that idea. I have plenty of friends that keep the Post-it over their little webcam on their laptops for fear that someone may be looking at them through their computer and everything else. So it's an uncomfortable topic, knowing that someone is collecting and accumulating information on you. So the more you can be honest about what it is and how it's being used, the better.
Yep, good advice. Another thing that lawmakers are always conscious of when dealing with the video game industry is the violence piece, and not just violence in the game, but I think, you know, a related topic is the way that online players interact with each other, which, you know, may or may not, depending on whatever study you're reading these days, have some relationship to the violence in the game or games, and how that is impacting our society as a whole. I know that in 2013, President Obama actually asked the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, to study whether video games are linked to violence. I haven't seen a whole lot of follow-up information or conclusions on that request. I guess we can just assume that the research is ongoing. But as I mentioned a moment ago, people are always doing studies that either say violence is in video games is damaging our society, or there is no link between violence in video games and the violence we see in our society, or maybe there are studies that come out and say something in between those two polar points. But it's something that lawmakers pay attention to. And in fact, just in the last week, Ars Technica was paying attention to a talk that Justice Kagan of the U.S. Supreme Court gave in November at Princeton. She was being asked about the California case that was called Brown versus EMA, that considered whether California could enact a law that would put some pretty tight restrictions on selling violent video games to minors, tighter than what we already have in California right now, and a little more amorphous. It wouldn't just be based on the ESRB rating of the game, whether it was violent, but it would be subject to a kind of a variety of the Miller test for obscene content. It's sort of a squishy test that looks at community standards and things and what average people think about the property in question. So you would get a whole bunch of variables in deciding whether or not a game was violent. The Supreme Court split 5-4 on whether that California law was going to be constitutional, and ultimately found that it was not, and that the free speech value of the games trumped any interest that the state would have in controlling the sale of them to minors. But Justice Kagan at this talk talked in detail about how conflicted she was about deciding this case. And if she had gone the other way, then California's law would be constitutional. So it was a good illustration of just how difficult this issue is for judges and lawmakers, and the violence issue is just not going to go away. So I wanted to get your take on, first of all, Justice Kagan's comments and the state of the art in violence in video games, and how what kind of a concern it is to the developers that you know. Can we start with Patrick?
Yeah, I mean, I just saw the article on Justice Kagan. Of course, I get her concern. Everybody wants to understand and think about what, you know, what can be bought. But that's a parenting issue, and I think she got it right in her vote. Whether she laments the vote or not, it doesn't mesh with free expression, and that's what she ultimately decided. So as far as I'm concerned, this is pretty much a dead issue. Although it's easy political fodder for people to jump in and say, you know, like, we should study it more, or other states have, you know, still tried to figure out ways to regulate it or to tax it, to tax violent video games in whatever capacity. But as far as I'm concerned, this is a dead issue. The ESRB does a great job in rating their games, and it's not a government entity, which is the whole point. So thankfully, it's more or less put to rest for a while.
Mm-hmm. You know, all this made me think back to a few years ago. I think it was in 2006, the CleanFlix case, where somebody attempted to develop a product that would—I forget exactly how it worked technologically. If it altered a movie as it was playing, or if it distributed an altered version of the movie, but it was called CleanFlix. And the idea was to take an otherwise objectionable violent movie and clean it up a bit, take out the gory parts, the profanity, the nudity, the sex, etc. And it did not pass muster for similar reasons, for free speech and, you know, altering the artistic expression of the creator kind of reasons. But I don't think that anyone has attempted a clean flicks kind of strategy toward video games, but I could certainly see someone trying. Couldn't you, Suzanne?
I could see someone trying. I've seen developers try. I have a game in my living room right now that the name of which escapes me, of course, because I'm being recorded. That at the beginning of the game, it asked me if I'm okay with swearing, blood, and gore. And of course, I clicked yes, but people have the option to say no. So I think developers understand that that is an issue that needs to be addressed. I don't think anyone technological would want to change the content of games enough to make an alteration on that level, though, because there are such a wide range of games that if you don't want blood and gore, you have plenty of options. And if you do want blood and gore, you have plenty of options. I would also like to point out my undergrad degree is in psychology, and I did some work in the psychology field. So whenever I see studies come out that say violent video games cause violence, I just causation is, or correlation is not causation. You haven't controlled for all the external factors. How do you know that this isn't a self-selecting group? Did you test all age groups, all types of games, all type levels of playing and everything else? It's a mess when studies get into the news.
Yeah, absolutely. It's confusing. And of course, you can find the study that proves exactly whatever your foregone conclusion was and then argue absolutely from there if you want to. But I do think this is an interesting issue. I wish you could remember what game it was that you can
you
readily
mind,
turn off the violence.
I can run out and grab it.
Oh, do it after the show, maybe, and I'll stick it in the discussion points. My son is continually telling me that there are games out there that he wants to buy and play that have that option, and it seems like unfailingly we get them home, and that option's not there, and it's just, you know, blood and guts and gore all over the place. So I'd like to see more of that as a parent in games, and I hope that the industry does more to give people that option. Certainly that's a night. Ah, what is it?
Sorry, it's Brutal Legend.
Brutal Legend, I'm writing it down. So it's clearly an M-rated game, right?
I don't think it's M-rated because of the option to switch it off. If you switch off the violence and the blood and gore and swearing, it would probably be an E-rated game. But if you leave it on, yes, it would be an M-rated game.
Right. So I think that's kind of a moving target, right? I think that parents want it. It's not as widely available as it might be. And certainly the clean flicks type approach has its legal problems. Mona, any thoughts?
I mean, we bring up the regulation and censorship of games and media content in general, and something we have to keep into consideration whenever we're talking about our clients, is that even if it's not necessarily a state censored issue in the US because we have this whole freedom of speech thing, most of these games are hopefully going to be distributed internationally. We can't say the same universally. We can't say that there are not going to be state regulated content issues that we're going to come across in the future. Australia has Australia and the UK, I think, both have some pretty strict state sanctioned censorship issues that come into play. So it's not like we're totally free from this from a global perspective. So it's fine to say that the U.S. Offers that freedom of speech protection, but it doesn't protect the developer nearly as much as people think. Censorship is always going to be an issue. ESRB guidelines, Patrick was saying, are absolutely great. I think it's a wonderful system. But at the end of the day, censorship is always going to be an issue. It's going to be something that developers always have to think about if they want to see any success in their product. Some people get off on the sensationalism behind really violent video games, and that's fine. I am a strong believer in freedom of expression. I just think that the reality is that censorship is always going to be an issue.
Right. I as a parent, it's interesting for me to watch kids' reactions to games and what they're allowed to play, what they're not allowed to play. One of my friend's sons the other day had a comment about how I'm just not a violent person at all, but God, I love destroying things in games. You know, it's just, there's something very cathartic about it for him. And I know this kid well, and I believe him that he can blow stuff up and blood and guts and gore everywhere, and that it's not having an impact on him where it's making him a more violent person. He's a really gentle person.
Well, I think you touched on two things there, Denise. I mean, you know, one, there are far more television shows that I'd be worried about my kid watching than playing games. And and two, you like you keep saying, as a parent, you have a concern. I think that's a valid concern. I have that same concern with my kids. I just don't think it's a government responsibility. That's all.
Yeah. All right. Well, for the Video Game Bar Association, the CDC ratings are great. I agree. But they could use even more detail, I think, from the parental standpoint. They tell you what's in a game. But again, I'd love the ability to turn some stuff off and to know more about it without having, you know, I mean, I guess it's a really good private industry solution.
Right.
But but again, you need a bit more to make decisions as a parent. You need to be going to something like Common Sense Media and seeing their take from people who've actually played through and know the game well. Let's see, other regulation and policy issues. We should put a second MCLE passphrase in the show before we close out here. And since Suzanne did the great mental effort of figuring out the game she was thinking of, Brutal Legend, let's make that our second phrase for the show. And before we get out of here, I wanted to ask you guys, since we're coming up on a vote on net neutrality in the FCC next month, how those issues impact the gaming industry now that so much of it is happening, either the gameplay itself is online and a bandwidth issue, or the distribution of the games, or both. Suzanne, do you think the gaming industry is paying attention to net neutrality and what it might mean for them?
I think they're trying. There's so much on either side and so much back and forth that it's hard to get down to the nitty gritty of the actual issue and how things will play out. For my end, I'm being more responsive than reading ahead and trying to figure out, well, if this comes through, if we don't get net neutrality, and if Steam, heaven forbid, starts getting throttled, what would be the appropriate response? How would that be handled on our end?
And what do you think?
I think that it would just wind up being a mess because you'd have to pay for wider bandwidth on the behalf of the distributor or whoever else. Or maybe it would be independent publishers that are paying for greater bandwidth. And when everything is digital, it's a huge issue to kind of shut it down like that.
Is this something that comes into play in the development stages when you're working with clients, Patrick? How the game's going to be distributed and what sort of bandwidth considerations might be necessary and might need to be built in?
We definitely talk about it in the agreements relative to development, processes, pipeline specifications, and things along those lines. The issue of net neutrality or if there's going to be more bandwidth that's going to be required hasn't really come up in specifically, other than obviously it's what it's going to ultimately boil down to is going to be a pricing issue, right? If if there's more bandwidth costs that the game companies have to pay, they're gonna squeeze somewhere else, and eventually that's probably going to get passed down to the consumers and end up paying more for the game to offset that, or paying more directly for the bandwidth. So one way or another, I think the consumer is going to end up paying more in that scenario. I haven't seen any agreements that are directly responsive to the potential of the net neutrality efforts.
Mona, what do you think?
I mean, I think it's as Patrick says, as of yet, it hasn't really been an issue because it's not something that's been actively enforced. So the person who's ultimately going to suffer is going to be the consumer. It's going to be the end user. I mean, and it's a horrible situation, but it's kind of, hopefully it's something that we won't have to deal with. I think that's kind of cautious optimism is what we're looking towards. But, the reality is that it might come through. And if so, we'll see what happens down that road. It's not something that I've really confronted with in a lot of deals because it's just not a consideration at this point yet.
All right. Well, we're watching it as it might impact many industries. And this is just one of them, of course. Let's go on to our tip and resource of the week. Our tip of the week is for all of you out there. Suzanne, maybe a couple of years ago, this might have been you, who think you might want to attend college on a gamer scholarship. There are actually two places in the United States where you can do that now. One is at the University of Pikeville in Kentucky, and the other one's in Chicago. Do you remember where that is, Suzanne?
I'm not entirely sure, no.
Now, hold on, I have to look it up.
I only knew about the one in Kentucky.
Robert Morris University in Chicago was the first school to make League of Legends an official sport. And now University of Pikeville is jumping in too. There are going to be 20 gamer scholarships given away at the University of Pikeville. Playing League of Legends is going to be part of the school's sports program. They're calling it varsity esports. And They are treating the gamer athletes just like other athletes. They're going to have GPA requirements they have to maintain. They're going to have practice time and time spent, you know, reviewing videos of other players and developing strategy. They're going to be coaches, etc. So this is a thing, gamer athletes. What do you think, Suzanne?
I think it's awesome that it's reaching this level of legitimacy. I mean, esports, as far as a from an observer standpoint, are packing stadiums and being watched online in huge numbers. Dota tournaments, League of Legends tournaments, these people are becoming real celebrities, the players. So it's good to see this kind of legitimacy coming through the university network. It's really exciting. It's changing the definition of what is a sport, what constitutes a sport, whether or not the physical aspects of sports are really necessary. And I mean, there is a physical aspect to gaming, so it'll be an interesting to see whether or not it sticks and continues as a trend.
Right. The new media director at University of Pikeville says, what makes a good League of Legends player and esports player also makes a good student. So does this say something overall, something broader, Patrick, about the role of games in education in our lives?
Absolutely. I mean, again, I think, you know, the fact that it's reaching down to this level at the esports and the player level is phenomenal. But there's been a meteoric rise, I think, in at the university level of schools that are having a game development program, usually tied to their computer science division. University of Texas just started a really, really good one that I'm going to be speaking at in March. USC here in Los Angeles has the top games program, I believe, in the country, according to the Princeton Review. That's a phenomenal group. So they've been educating people on that level on how to make games. The Texas one is more of a management level one. Law schools, there's a dozen law schools that offer specific courses in video game law. So this has been happening in a variety of places and a variety of levels at the university level, at the university system. So this is great to see it at as an esports level.
Right. And it's worth mentioning that although there are only two colleges in the U.S. where you can get a scholarship to play League of Legends, more than 230 universities and colleges are competing in the Collegiate Start League, which I guess plays that game. Can you tell us something about that game, Suzanne?
It's a team game where you battle it out. Basically, you select your character, you can upgrade, you can choose particular weapons, and it's an arena style battle game. It's a lot of fun. A lot of my friends are really into it. I'm not nearly on their level, nor do I make any claim that I could win a competition, but it's a fun time to get out there and do something with a bunch of people.
All right. Mona, any thoughts about gaming scholarships or esports in general?
The workhorse in me is kind of obsessing over how is that going to play out with players who are with existing MLG teams. I had a friend who I actually helped with his Evil Geniuses contracts whenever he was working with that team. Whenever we're talking about MLG teams, you know, these are endorsed, you know, heavily sponsored teams. They have contracts with their players. So how are these scholarships going to play into that? Are they going to be prohibitive as far as being able to work with existing teams and existing leagues? And I'm kind of interested to see how that's going to work out for these agreements for the players.
Right. So what you're saying, first of all, what does MLG stand for?
Major League Gaming.
Major League Gaming. So you're saying what you're describing is a world that's sort of like skateboarding and surfing, where the really talented young players are scouted and identified and sponsored and signed.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's been going on for years. I went to an MLG tournament in, I want to say 2008, 2009 maybe. And a friend of mine was playing. It's the same one who I was helping with his agreements. And it's a huge thing. I mean, it's a massive event. And you see it, you know, anytime you go to PAX, you see the MLG tournament or the League of Legends tournaments that are happening there. But MLG is becoming a real thing. It's becoming a real industry. And so I'm interested to see how that's going to grow.
All right. Well, we have a couple of resources for you in keeping with our gaming episode today. One is, it's called, actually, I don't know if it has its own name, but the Internet Archive has over, it might be called the Incredible Machine. That's what this graphic says anyway, but it has over 2,000 free classic MS-DOS games that it's bringing to your browser. Again, the legal status of these games is somewhat questionable, but for the time being, they are up at the Internet Archive. We've got games like Duke Nukem 3D, which also is actively on sale, which is why that particular one might be a problem. But Wolfenstein 3D, some Lemmings titles, Oregon Trail, love that one. That one's also on sale. I know it's available in the app stores for mobile devices. Incredible Machine is a game itself. The King's Quest games, I remember those. The Island of Dr. Brain, Leisure Suit Larry, of course, and a lot of other Sierra games. Over 2,000 games available at the Internet Archive to play in your browser. And some of them, there's no ability to save games. It's kind of an interesting experience playing in your browser. It's not going to be, you know, exactly what you remember, but just making them available is kind of fun. But as the author of this piece in PC World points out, enjoy it while you can, because the legal status of these things is somewhat dicey. Suzanne, any thoughts?
I'm excited to have them available. A lot of them I already have on my Steam account legitimately, but it's retro, it's fun, it's good to go after, but the legal issues won't let it be there for too long.
All right. And then our second resource is just for fun for our viewers and listeners who like to play the Twill drinking game. We have a way that you can augment that. The Twill drinking game is generally whenever anyone speaks in Latin on the show or makes a Monty Python reference, or, you know, you guys in IRC will have to remind me of all the other things that are part of the Twill drinking game. But over at Above the Law, which is a fun sort of snarky website that gossips about the legal industry. They highlight the fact that a lot of law students, when they're bored in class, play law school bingo, which is very similar. You make up a bingo card and put things on it, like various Latin terms. And I never personally was sitting in a law school class where someone shouted out bingo, but it's probably happened. So if you're interested in augmenting your Twill drinking game, I encourage you to head on over to the Above the Law article that's in our discussion points at Delicious. There are words in there that you can add, that lots of Latin phrases like per se, penumbras and emanations, prima facie, query or quare, fungible, rem, proximate cause, or Paul's graph, all kinds of other fun things to add to your legal lexicon and make your viewing of This Week in Law even more fun and or liquid, if that's the way that you like to enjoy the show. So just wanted to toss that out for you. I have had so much fun chatting today with our gaming panel. I hope you guys have too. Thank you so much, Suzanne, for joining us once again.
Glad to be back. It was a wonderful time.
It was. And Patrick and Mona of IE Law Group, great that you guys are developing your gaming law practice. We'll continue to pay attention to the game. One more time, it's the Video Game Bar Association, right, Patrick?
Correct.
You said you have a speaking thing coming up soon. Anything else that you want to point people toward before we go ahead and round out the show?
Well, we'll all be at GDC in San Francisco coming up in March. I think Suzanne, Mona, and I are all attending that. South by Southwest and the University of Texas is also in March.
Chicago,
that's right. There, Suzanne's got a conference that she's helping run in association with John Marshall Law School, I believe, in March. Suzanne, you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a legal and business-focused conference out in Chicago. It's the Chicago Video Game Law Summit, and it's at the end of March. So we're going to have awesome speakers like Patrick and Mona come out and talk about legal issues in the industry, and we've got a couple developers to talk about the business side, and it's just going to be a fun time.
Wonderful. I am so glad you guys are doing what you do. It's kind of the Wild West of legal issues concerning video games, but it's good to know there are smart people like yourselves applying your gray matter and trying to help both users and developers get it right. So thank you so much for joining us today on This Week in Law. If you have been joining us live, that means that you too have joined us here on Friday at 11 o'clock in the morning, California time, 1900 UTC. That's when we record the show every week. But don't think that you have to do that all the time. It's great when you can. We love it when you can join us live. But don't be concerned. We're going to be there for you on demand. As far as I know, no one is muting out any of our audio when you listen to us on demand after the fact. You can do that by going to twit.tv/twill. You can go to youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. You can go to iTunes. You can watch us on your Roku, however you like to enjoy the show. We're going to be there for you. And if you go to the Twit page, the twit.tv/twill page, there are a whole myriad of ways you can enjoy the show after we have recorded. So whatever works best for you, we're just thrilled to have you. You are so important to our doing of this show. Our listeners and viewers love to hear from you, love to know what you've thought of our discussions, love to know what other issues it made you think of that we didn't touch on. We'd love to hear about that. You can email me. I'm denise@twit.tv. You can reach me on Twitter. I'm D Howell over there. And we have Google Plus and Facebook pages for the show too, if you have a bit more to say. Love hearing from you about what you think we should discuss, what you thought of what we did discuss, and who you think we should have on the show. Those are all real fruitful areas of discussion with me between the shows. So please take advantage and let me know what's on your mind. Thank you so much for joining us once again for this gaming-oriented issue of This Week in Law. And we'll let you get back to your consoles, right? We've taken up way too much of your time. Thanks so much. We'll see you next week.